Welcome to episode 10 of While I Breathe, the official podcast of the ACLU of South Carolina. I'm your host, Jace Woodrum.
And I'm your other host, Paul Bowers. On this episode, I want to take a look behind the curtain for a minute and explain something. In addition to being my lovely co-host, Jace is also my boss. And this means that today, well, I guess I'm going to be in a kind of an awkward position where I have to interview my boss a little bit. I don't know if any of y'all have ever done that, but I wanted to have him on not just as a co-host as usual, but also as a guest to talk about what we're going to talk about today. So acknowledging that awkwardness up front, I want to start by reintroducing Jace to y'all. So Jace Woodrum is correct me if I'm getting this wrong, Jace, is, as far as we know, the first ever transgender executive director of a state ACLU affiliate. So Jace has made some history here in South Carolina. And my question for you, Jace, is how does it feel to be a first? How does it feel to return to your home state and do this work?
I mean, it's as awkward to be asked a question like that at times as it is to, I suppose, interview your boss. But I'm always happy to talk to you, Paul. And I'll say, when I think about being the first, it comes with really a lot of different emotions. You know, on the one hand, I'm surprised because there are so many amazing transgender leaders all across this country who have done incredible work on whose shoulders I stand. And so it's a little bit surprising that I'm the first to hold this role within the ACLU context. It feels very humbling to have been chosen to lead this organization, as you know, any person I think often feels humbled to lead an organization like the ACLU that has been around for over 100 years doing such incredible civil rights work. And then it also makes me feel hopeful that there is change afoot and that transgender people are more and more accepted every day, and that I may be the first, but I am far from the last. And I came home to do this work because it felt important for me to do so, given the privilege that I have. You know, I came out as transgender when I was living in Colorado, a state that really affirms transgender people. And I had a supportive job, I had supportive family, I had supportive friends, I had the ability to access healthcare, the ability to update my identity documents, and many other privileges that people across this country and a lot of people right here in South Carolina do not have. And I believe very strongly in using your privilege, using your power to create change in this world. And so that's why I came home to South Carolina, where the attacks on transgender people are so intense and so harmful. And I'm really honored to be able to stand with trans South Carolinians and their families to fight back against those attacks.
Well, I'm glad we got you back from Colorado, Jace, and I consider it a point of pride to work with you. I'm really glad that we get to do this work together.
Oh, Paul, that's sweet.
Not just saying that because you're my boss, I swear.
Hard to believe.
Well, Jace, you know, the reason I'm having you on as both a guest and co-host today is we are talking about trans rights in South Carolina and about something that we're doing as an organization to fight for those rights. So today we're going to be talking about an ongoing lawsuit that our legal team helped file back at the end of August 2024. Name of the case is Ms. Zanin v. Wilson. Ms. Zanin being the lead plaintiff, Sterling Ms. Zanin, in our case, Wilson being South Carolina Attorney General Alan Wilson. So in that case, we are challenging a major piece of anti-trans legislation that the governor signed into law earlier this year. This is a bill that our advocacy team fought tooth and nail alongside our allies, our incredible LGBTQ rights organizations around the state. They fought this as long as they could, and the lawmakers still passed it. And so now that it is law and it is harming people, our legal team has sprung into action. So from our legal team today, we're going to have Meredith McPhail, our staff attorney. And Jace, I'm trying to think of how I should introduce Meredith.
Yeah, I actually told this to Meredith the other day that between this case and another case we have fighting for our plaintiff, Sophia Kano, who is trying to access gender-affirming healthcare while incarcerated, Meredith is becoming one of a very small group of litigators in this country who really know the ins and outs of anti-trans policy and the unconstitutionality of these policies. So I'm so proud of Meredith leading us on this case and the work that she's doing. And I think folks who are listening will just be in awe of her brilliance as we are.
Yeah. I think one thing I would add about Meredith is I've gotten to see her talk to plaintiffs, and, you know, lawyers come in all different types. Some of them are a little warmer and more personable. Some of them are a little colder and more, I suppose, argumentative. Meredith is genuinely a people person. You know, when she does this work, when she's talking to Sophia Kano, she's doing this work from a place of real care. And I see that in her. I see that when she's working with Brittany Martin, another plaintiff that she's been fighting for a long time now. And again, in this case, you know, it's she's a brilliant legal mind, but she's also someone who cares genuinely. And I see that driving her forward. So I'm sure she'll blush when she listens to this, but I mean it all. So I guess we are as set up as we can be for this conversation. Are you ready to go, Jace?
Let's get into it.
Let's do it. Okay, joining us now, we have Meredith McPhail. Meredith, how are you?
I'm doing great, Paul. Thanks so much for having me. How does it go? I'm a longtime listener, first-time caller.
That's right. Yeah, I need to up my radio DJ game. But thank you so much for joining us, Meredith. This is, yeah, as you say, your first time on the podcast, but I'm really excited that you're going to be here to explain this case that we're working on and share a little bit of your expertise. So for starters, Jace, Meredith, I wanted to talk about the law that we're challenging. As it was passing through the state legislature, it was known as House Bill 4624. The lawmakers pushing it gave it the nickname the Help Not Harm Bill, which, as we'll get into, is a misnomer. What is in this law, and who is it actively harming right now?
Let me do some big picture stuff. H4624 bans medically necessary gender-affirming health care for anyone under the age of 18. It also prohibits public funds from being used to provide gender-affirming healthcare for any transgender South Carolinian of any age. And when we think about public funds, we think about folks who have Medicaid or folks who are public employees and have the state public employee insurance plan. We also have a situation here in South Carolina where MUSC has, as a result of this law, has cut off all care to transgender people of all ages. So we have, you know, hundreds of folks in the state who have lost access to medically necessary gender-affirming healthcare. You know, for me, as a transgender person, I've been on hormones for about 12 years now. I cannot imagine what it would feel like to lose access to that care. I've spent years building a relationship with my doctor. I have achieved incredible peace in living authentically and having who I am on the outside reflect how I feel on the inside. And all of my anxiety and stress and depression that existed before starting my gender transition, I just know it would come back in a you know, full force kind of way. And so, you know, before we get into the the legal part of this. I just want to be so clear about the harm that this law is causing to trans South Carolinians of all ages.
Yeah, thanks so much, Jace, for sharing that with us. And it's really ironic that the nickname is Help Not Harm when it's the opposite of what the law is doing. And it's taking that distress that Jace described and multiplying it exponentially across the state for adults who are having their care disrupted and for children whose parents and doctors have decided that they need the care.
Yeah. I remember you going to some of the state house hearings when this bill was being debated. A lot of the conversation was specifically about children, and you know, there were folks, including medical experts, family members, adult trans people, who told lawmakers again and again, this is going to affect adults too. And they just did not seem especially interested in addressing that. And now here we are, and it is affecting adults. As we'll get into in discussing this case, you know, we have plaintiffs in this case who are adults who have lost access to care abruptly. And that is a really scary prospect for a lot of people. So after the bill passed, after the governor signed it into law, we started hearing about its effects, and eventually the legal team decided that we needed to take action here. So Meredith, I was wondering if you could talk about this lawsuit and what parts of the law we're specifically challenging.
Yeah, absolutely. So like Jay said, there's three main provisions of the law that we're challenging in this lawsuit. And the first is a prohibition on medical professionals providing this gender-affirming care to any South Carolinians under 18. And there's also a prohibition on the use of public funds or Medicaid coverage for gender-affirming care for anybody, no matter what their age. And we're challenging these three provisions on behalf of our individual plaintiffs. And also, we're asking the court to treat this case like a class action, which would basically say that there are large groups who are being affected by this law. And it's in three kind of major categories, which is one, the children who are being denied care, two, their parents, and three, adults who are being denied care under the public funds provision. And we're challenging these parts of the laws as unconstitutional under the Equal Protection and Due Process Clause of the Constitution, and also as violating several different federal statutes.
So, as you mentioned, we have different classes of plaintiffs here, representing different groups of people who are being harmed in different ways right now. Most of them are filing anonymously. You know, they'll use a pseudonym like Jane Doe, John Doe, that kind of thing. We do have one named plaintiff who is willing to have his name out there. What can you share about these plaintiffs and their stories?
Well, like you said, Paul, they're proceeding under pseudonym in large part because they don't necessarily feel safe fighting this fight publicly. And that says a lot about what it is to be a trans person or a supporter of a trans person in South Carolina, first and foremost. But essentially, these are all folks who were going about their everyday lives, working with their doctors or their children's doctors to get gender-affirming, medically necessary healthcare, and all of a sudden found out that the South Carolina legislature decided that this particular care for this particular reason shouldn't be allowed and are now suffering the consequences.
One thing that I think is really important on this issue is that the kind of care that the law prohibits is provided every day to people who are not transgender. Lots of people every day take hormone therapy. Kids who start puberty too early and are diagnosed with something called precocious puberty take the puberty blockers that are being banned. So what we're seeing here is that care is allowed for people who are not transgender, and it is being denied or banned for people who are transgender. So because of this law, in our state, some patients get the care they need and some don't. Some parents get to make healthcare decisions for their children and some don't. And some doctors get to follow the medical standard of care and some don't. And who decides? Politicians. That is absolutely unacceptable. And that's why we're challenging the constitutionality of this law.
Yeah, I think a common theme we've seen in lawmaking this year is that folks in our legislature who purport to be in favor of small government want the government to be small enough to fit into your doctor's office, to fit into your bedroom, into spaces where the government has no business being. And it's so arbitrary. It is so frustrating that certain parents get to have access to care for their kids. Other parents do not. As a parent, I can't imagine. Yeah, in this lawsuit, we're fighting for parents of trans youth. We're fighting for trans adults, people in a lot of different situations who are being treated unfairly because of who they are or who their children are. And that's just so fundamental to the work we do here, to fight for people in that type of situation.
And that sounds really terrible in the abstract, but it's even worse when you hear the nitty-gritty details of what these families are having to go through. These are folks who have fought for years to get their children the care that they need and into a good place. And, you know, for certain individuals, that care has been provided, has been successful, and it's going to be stopped. You know, I can't imagine being put in a situation where your child's receiving medically necessary care and all of a sudden someone tells you, we don't do that here anymore. Mm-hmm. What do? You know, spend money traveling out of state? Do you move out of state and uproot your whole family? Do you get a new job? I mean, these are the choices that those families are being forced to make right now.
Yeah, there's a little bit of a myth about access to gender-affirming care. I felt like our lawmakers were sort of saying, like, doctors are getting rich providing this care and there are gender clinics on every corner. And, you know, I've been through this and I've lived through it in multiple states now. It is extremely difficult to find a healthcare provider who has any expertise in gender-affirming care. Wait lists are really long. When you do find someone, processes are long. There is no drive-through hormone pickup. There are no, like, bright shining lights for surgery, okay? It is extremely difficult to access, especially for youth, because a young person who is accessing gender-affirming healthcare has to have parental consent. So you have to think, okay, this young person has to know themselves, come out, have supportive parents, and have the funds or insurance coverage, and then find the doctor in a state like South Carolina that is still pretty rural in a lot of places. It is huge, hugely full of barriers. And I feel like our lawmakers were just pushing these myths to justify this harmful policy.
We heard a lot of myths during the legislative process. Some flatly silly ones, some very serious accusations being leveled. And I think one fundamental misunderstanding is about what we mean when we say gender-affirming care and what that means at different ages, you know, what that looks like for a child, an adolescent, and an adult can be very different and can vary based on who the patient is. I guess let's talk a little bit about that. You know, for an adolescent in South Carolina, what types of gender affirming care did people previously have access to, and what are they now being denied access to?
I'm glad you asked this, Paul. So many people think that when a child at 4 or 5 expresses their gender identity, that means they show up at the doctor's office and get medical care. In fact, no medical care happens until the close to onset of puberty. Before puberty, a gender transition looks like calling a child by a different name or using different pronouns or changing a haircut or changing clothing. That's called a social transition. And that's all that happens before puberty. With parental consent, children can begin taking puberty blockers right at or just before the onset of puberty. Puberty blockers is a medication that pauses puberty. They were originally developed not for transgender people, but for children who start puberty too early, just to pause. So we've been using this medication for some time now. And so for transgender kids, puberty blockers give them the chance to know themselves better and stop what can be the most painful psychologically period in their lives. Because for potentially the first time in their life, these transgender kids are feeling their body change in a way that feels so incongruous with who they are. So that tension, that anxiety, that depression really hits so, so hard at puberty. And that's why puberty blockers have been the standard of care for transgender kids at that age. And so if kids are still affirming their gender identity and if they have parental support after puberty blockers, they may begin hormone therapy. And hormone therapy is something that's provided to people every day. And again, it is something that is provided with doctor, parent, and patient involvement, not politicians. That is not a decision that politicians should make. And I guess the last thing I'll say about this is that we heard from pediatricians and medical providers during testimony for this bill that surgeries are not happening for transgender youth in South Carolina. And so a lot of lawmakers want people to think that's what this bill did, stopped transgender surgeries. And in fact, we know that surgeries for transgender kids was not happening. It's very, very rare anywhere in the United States. It may not really even happen in the United States. If it does, it's really rare. And so it's just another myth. Perhaps it's more fair to call it a lie that was used to justify this law.
You know, another important point about puberty blockers and hormone therapy relates not only to the mental health and well-being of these individuals currently, of these adolescents, but also to what medical procedures are going to be necessary down the line. So, for example, when an adolescent goes through puberty that does not correspond with their gender identity, they might develop in ways that would have to be remedied later with surgery. That can be, something that families want to avoid. Right. And so there's a lot of considerations that go into these calls. And that is kind of fundamentally the core of this is politicians are trying to tell doctors and parents and patients what they can and can't do when that decision simply does not belong anywhere near the state house.
Preach.
So we do have, you know, a section of our case that is about adults being denied care. And I've been fortunate enough to talk a couple times now with Sterling, our named plaintiff, who is an adult trans man. He's someone who came out while living in South Carolina. And, you know, he told us that he has a supportive community here. He has friends and family and people around him who understand or seek to understand him. And he's been able to build that community here, but he has had to really work to just get access to medical care. And his story is so frustrating. And he went through all the hurdles that you have to go through to get scheduled for surgeries. And he was all set at the Medical University of South Carolina to receive surgery. And it was shortly before the scheduled day, he got a call out of the blue from MUSC saying that's been canceled because of this new law. And to have gone through years of medical tests, to go through the whole rigmarole that you must go through to get that care, and then to have it denied at the last minute is so frustrating. And you know, I'm really grateful that he was willing to share his story. It's been out in there in the media a little bit, just to demonstrate that, you know, this law is affecting adults as well as minors and parents of minors. And that's one key myth that came up in the, you know, passage of this law, is that it's just about children, and it is not. It is harming adults right now. Well, if we can maybe transition to a lighter sort of topic, one really kind of out there assertion that we heard during the lead up to passing this bill was a lot of stuff about kids using litter boxes in schools, or like, you know, dressing up as cats.
I've got an example in Greenwood where a young lady was authorized to be a cat, or call herself a cat, a feline. And so that was encouraged. I've got proof of that. It seems to me that if a student wants to identify as a cat, then certainly their parents need to know about it, probably get some mental health treatment, even to the point of asking them to put a litter box in the bathroom.
Jace, do you remember this? What was going on there? What were they talking about?
Oh, I remember, Paul. I remember it well. you know, we live in the internet age, right? And it is so, so easy for just outrageous lies to circulate and to become embraced as if they're true. And this is a classic example. This story has been debunked. Litter boxes are not being used in schools. This is really just a ridiculous proposition pushed by some of the lawmakers at the committee level. And when asked to cite their sources, they cited, "Oh, I heard it from my granddaughter." Mm-hmm. And when shown the sort of debunked news, you know, they weren't willing to change their tune. So it is absolutely not true that students are using litter boxes, and it's downright offensive that we would suggest that transgender kids are animals. I mean, that's what I feel like is underneath this, this dehumanizing effort to make the folks who are being attacked into, you know, non-humans. And that is disgusting.
It is not a serious allegation. It has no basis in truth, but it has really serious consequences. Like Jay said, for this kind of using this kind of dehumanizing language and using it in service of depriving people healthcare.
Another, I think, more serious assertion that was made was that, you know, other countries are moving away from providing gender affirming care. You know, they'd point to the United Kingdom or to certain Scandinavian countries and say, well, you know, look, like they're moving away. The science is changing somehow. What do you make of that? Is that really what's been going on?
There have been efforts, coordinated efforts to discredit what is the standard of care here in the United States and what is effective medically necessary treatment for gender dysphoria in adolescents and adults. And frankly, those efforts say some pretty scary things, right? They say these treatments aren't tested. They say these treatments are irreversible. They say these treatments are mutilation. And that sounds really scary, you know? And if I didn't know any better, I would be worried about that, right? But when you dig into the substance of the claims and when you look at what medical care is actually provided, you realize that those claims are not based in reality, right? And there's a reason that there are efforts to debunk this medical care with regard to gender dysphoria specifically, right? There's no lawmakers in South Carolina calling for banning puberty blockers for precocious puberty. Why? Because it's safe and it works, and that's what doctors recommend. But this law is targeted at trans individuals, and it's using a lot of mis and disinformation that, quite frankly, is scary when you hear it, but isn't actually true.
Yeah, puberty blockers came up a lot in legislative debate. And, you know, we heard assertions that these medications are dangerous or that they're irreversible. Is that true?
Puberty blockers are reversible. That's sort of the intent of them, is to stop puberty for whatever the reason. Because again, they are not just used for transgender people. And when you stop puberty blockers, puberty resumes. And so they're really not dangerous, or else hopefully we would have never developed them or not been providing them for years. And they are also reversible.
I've heard folks say that they're not reversible because they alter when puberty actually happens. But by that logic, no medication is ever reversible because all medication has some intended effect. And if we're saying that the existence of an intended effect in a medication means that it's irreversible, then every medication ever is irreversible.
I took an irreversible dose of ibuprofen this morning. I'll never get the headache back.
Right, exactly.
Yep.
I hope it had the intended impact.
It has been working. And if I want to stop, I can. Yeah. Thank you so much for breaking this down. I think, you know, we hear a lot of nonsense, you know, ranging from the silly to the serious. And I really appreciate you sharing your expertise, both of you. Is there anything else we should talk about on this case? I mean, is there anything else you would want people to know about Ms. Anen v. Wilson and the arguments we're making here?
I think the core of this case and the core of a lot of what we do at the ACLU comes down to loving your neighbor and the golden rule. How would you feel if your child needed care and the South Carolina's legislature stepped in and said no? What would you do? Would you quit your job and move to another state? Would you let your kids suffer? No one deserves to be put in that position. And so we're here fighting because we love our neighbors here in South Carolina. And I hope people can take a moment and put yourself in the shoes of the parents and the kids and the adults who are being denied care and think about what it means for them.
Yeah.
I couldn't agree more, Meredith. Thank you for that. I also say that the legal landscape on this issue is pretty complicated, and folks may have heard about different cases in different states, and there's a lot going on right now. If you feel overwhelmed, totally fair. What you should know is that our case starts here in South Carolina, but it is a federal court case, and we expect it to be appealed. You know, no matter what happens at this first level, we expect it to be going on for a while. The good news is that we're in this fight for a while and we're not going anywhere. The bad news is that, you know, we may not have a resolution for some time, and the harm that people are experiencing, you know, is not immediately taken care of when we file a lawsuit. The other important thing to know is that the U.S. Supreme Court is going to hear a case on a somewhat similar law. That law only impacts transgender young people. And so there could be some impact to us and to our case, but we still believe very strongly that we needed to file this case because we have all of those neighbors, our trans neighbors that Meredith was talking about. We want to fight for them. We have really solid legal precedent in our circuit. We have impact to both adults and kids. We have huge harm that is coming to people. We couldn't sit by and just think, we'll let the U.S. Supreme Court sort this out. So this won't be the last time we need to talk about this case or this issue, because we've got a long road ahead of us.
In that U.S. Supreme Court case, I believe that's Scrimeti, that case out of Tennessee. You know, our sibling organization, the ACLU of Tennessee, has been fighting that for a while alongside the national ACLU. And the timeline is, you know, stretches on for years, but you know, bills like this got introduced in legislatures all over the country. many of them passed. And then wherever they passed, there were groups of trans folks and organizations like the ACLU ready to fight back in court. So that brings us to today. Jace, I had one last question for you. Beyond the confines of this one law that we're challenging, how would you describe the legal and social landscape in South Carolina for trans, non-binary, and gender non-conforming South Carolinians? I mean, in other words, once we defeat this law, what work do we still have to do here?
It is heartbreaking to say that right now, in this time in which we are living, transgender people are under pretty unprecedented political attack. We have been made into political pawns used to sow fear to drive voter turnout. It is harmful and wrong on every level. And yet, when we look back over the history of our country, we know that different groups have been targeted like this time and time again. The first social justice issue that I personally worked on was marriage for gay couples. And at the time, around 2010, I started in that work, but it long preceded me. But at the time, we othered gay couples. And we said, what will happen to gay couples if kids read about them in school, if they're gay teachers? We had a lot of myths and misconceptions then too. And we saw over time that change happen. It's very nonlinear. There were a lot of losses. I remember losing 10 times at the ballot when we asked people to vote on whether or not gay couples should be allowed to get married. And so change is not linear and often has this kind of pain that we're experiencing right now. And students of history will know that this story comes long before gay marriage, right? And has been the story of civil rights in this country, where we have progress and backlash and progress and backlash. And that's what we're in right now. Transgender people had incredible progress. Just in the 12 years since I came out, I've seen so much increased visibility and so much increased understanding. And we are in a period of backlash right now. And what that means is that we have to take the long view. We have to be in this work for the long haul. And this work has a lot of different facets. You know, this work isn't just filing lawsuits. It's testifying at the state house. It is organizing in our communities. It's telling our stories to help change people's hearts and minds, right? We have to let people know us in order to change their hearts and minds. And so we have a long road ahead of us. I'll also say that in the darkest of days, I remind myself that true liberation comes from people, comes from what we give to each other. No politician can grant us liberation. It comes from within, it comes from us, from our community, and the way we treat one another. And so the work is long and hard. We're in it, and we are so grateful for the folks around this state who are in it with us.
This has been episode 10 of While I Breathe, the official podcast of the ACLU of South Carolina.
Thanks so much for listening, everyone. And we've got a request for you as we close out the show today. In the spirit of telling the story of transgender people, of changing the hearts and minds of South Carolinians to support us, we're going to have an episode, or maybe a few episodes if I can convince Paul to do it, where we pose your questions to transgender South Carolinians. And to do that, we need your questions. So what questions do you have about transgender people in South Carolina, about their lives, about their experiences, about their challenges, about how these laws are impacting them, about the books they read or their favorite restaurants, whatever it is, what do you want to know from your transgender neighbors? We want you to email us so that we can put together some really cool conversations with some amazing transgender folks in this state. So, Paul, they're going to email you.
Yeah, let's do it this way. We've got an inbox that I check. It is info@aclusc.org. If you didn't want to send your questions there and just say something in the subject line about questions, or make sure it's clear you're asking a question for the podcast. And if it's a question that we want to take on the air, we'll use it in an upcoming episode. Yeah, I think this is something that I've been looking forward to doing as as a cisgender person. Sometimes I have questions that I would feel a little rude asking, unless it was a really close personal friend. And if you just have honest questions and you really want to understand what it is like to be a trans person, and especially a trans person in South Carolina, we want to help answer that. We want to help build just basic understanding of our neighbors. You know, our trans neighbors are a lot like us. Some of them are extraordinary people. Some of them are very boring people. You know, they are just our neighbors. And I really want to help us get to know each other a little better through this. So again, that email is info@aclusc.org.
Our stories matter, y'all. And while I breathe, I hope.